Okay, so I'm running the last leg of this. All right, so I'll be quick, and I'll try and not to be so terribly technical. But I'm going to try and address the mechanism of evolution. All right, we'll talk a little bit about the molecular evidence for evolution, and we're also going to be talking about the cell. All right, so I have the topics that we're going to be discussing. I actually named them in reverse order. So we're going to start by talking about the basic unit of life, that is the cell. Right? And it's my position that it is so complex that it is extremely unlikely to have developed on its own. Right? The second point that we're going to discuss today is that the molecular evidence for evolution does not prove common descent of all life from a single progenitor organism. Right? And the final point that I'd like to make today is that the proposed mechanism of evolution, that is mutation followed by natural selection, does not work and has never been demonstrated experimentally. All right, so let's start things off with the cell. All right, so before we talk about the cell, let's talk about what Darwin knew about the cell. Right, so The Origin of Species was published November 24th, 1859. Right, about this time, the emergence of cell theory was just starting to take off in the biological community. All right, so that is the theory that all life seems to be made up of and begin from cells. Right? And these first cell biologists, they noticed that the nucleus divided before the rest of the cell. Right? So in the early 19th century, this was the idea of a cell. They had protoplasm, right? And then there was a breakthrough in microscopy, and we saw this, a nucleus. Right? So this is kind of what Darwin knew as a cell. And we had no idea what it does biologically. Fast forward, late 20th century, this is a simplified version of what we know today. Okay? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that there's a big knowledge gap here. Okay, I'm telling you this is a simplified version. We have, I'm going to show you a short video that's going to take us inside the cell. Right, your cell has highways, has skeletons, it has transport proteins, right, and it actively reorganizes and polymerizes these things in response to all kinds of signals that it's getting from other cells. In time and space, your cell is talking to dozens of other cells, receiving signals from the equivalent would be like me talking to somebody from China with no phone. I mean, you're looking at right now polymerization of actin, right, which is the cytoskeleton. It's happening millions of times a second. Right, these are microtubules. What you're seeing here is a motor transport protein. This is kinesin. Right, your cells assemble highways, and it has these motor proteins walk along the highways. Right, so what I'm getting at here is this is a level of complexity Darwin could not even have fathomed. Okay, Pat showed you a picture of the Empire State Building and said, when you look at something like this, because of the level of design, you know there was a designer. I'm telling you, the complexity that you see in a cell isn't the order of the Empire State Building. It's on the order of New York City. That's one cell. All right, so actually, molecular biologists don't even argue over the cell anymore. They provide you with a different evidence, right? So let's talk about the so-called molecular evidence for evolution. So what is the basis for molecular evolution? That is to ask the question, what evidence for evolution is afforded by molecular biology? Well, any evolutionist molecular biologist will say it's from DNA, right? Incontrovertible DNA evidence that we have evolution going on at the molecular level, right? In fact, I've had somebody, the head of bioinformatics at Sloan Kettering, tell me that. Right, so let's say, what is DNA? It's a molecule. It's a molecule that encodes all the information that makes you you. It's actually made up of just four nucleotides. That's just smaller molecules. We'll call them A, T, C, and G. They're color-coded here. Right, and various iterations of these impart some sort of message. Right? So just looking at the structure, I have one strand. A's bind with T's, C's with G's. So when you have two strands running anti-parallel together, you have a complete molecule. That molecule twists, as you can kind of make out from this background here. It twists, and then you have that famous double helix structure. Right? So what can we do with this? What can DNA tell us? We can label these nucleotides with fluorescent tags, much like the colors that we're seeing here. And we can run them across a laser. right? The laser will read the fluorescent tag. We assign a color to a letter, right? We pull that out, and we have a DNA sequence. So we can sequence the DNA from a number of organisms. And you say, what can we use that for? Well, you can take a DNA sequence from organism one. You can align it, this is called a sequence alignment, with another organism's DNA. Count up the total bases. You have 21 total bases in this example. Three differences, right? So 19 divided by 21 times 100. That's 86% homologous. That means that these two sequences are 86% the same. So how an evolutionist uses this is to construct a tree, a relationship tree. They start from the earliest organism that they have. They call that the progenitor. And then from that, they say that life flows and branches off from that point. With time going increasing as you're going down this tree, also complexity of DNA is supposed to increase as we're going down this tree. Right, so the information encoded down here is supposed to be more complex than up here. Right, that's an assumption. We'll talk a little bit about that. These tuning forks, right, these are called points of divergence. This is where that there's a substantial change in the DNA. Right, so these are constructed by taking all of that sequence data and using some very sophisticated hierarchical statistics method, right, and they come up with something like this. So these groups, what I'm getting at here is these groups are based off of similarity. It's the similarity in DNA sequence that makes this. Well, if that's what's making the tree, it's the similarities, then this isn't a phylogenetic tree showing descent. It's a tree showing similarity, right? So when you see this in textbooks, it's not proving descent. It's proving similarity. So if I have a monkey up here and say a Darwinist down there, it doesn't prove that Darwin descended from a monkey. It just proves that they have very, very similar DNA. All right, let's give you a practical example. Let's take a 2010 Honda Accord. Right, that's a base model, bottom of the line. This is top of the line, same year. Right, let's bury them for, let's say, a couple thousand years. Right, and a couple of archaeologists come along and they find these two cars. So they do what scientists do. They make a list of things that are different. Right, so the bottom of the line one, they make this list. It says air conditioning, power windows, power locks, cruise control, and so on. Right, they make the same list for the top of the line one. This one has all of these features plus some more. Right? Bluetooth and satellite and all kinds of cool stuff. Right? So the uniformitarian would interpret this as the red car having evolved after the silver one because it has all the features of the silver car and some original ones of its own. When the reality, as we know, is that the cars were designed by the same group, created at the same time, one being made more complex than the other. The mechanism of evolution. Right? So I'm going to try and hammer this home. Mutation and natural selection don't work. All right, so let's see. Well, we're going to go through selection, we're going to go through mutation, and finally we're going to go through this point that mutation is supposed to provide some sort of reproductive advantage. All right, so let's start with how evolution works. We have alternating pressures of mutation followed by natural selection. All right, so in a population, you have mutants, and some of those mutants get selected for. Right, so supposedly, the success of an organism is measured by the number of offspring left behind. Right, so the most successful organisms, the ones that are most perfectly adapted for that situation, produce more, and then therefore the population is made up more of that type of individual. This was correctly identified by Conrad Waddington as a tautology, that is a self-fulfilling statement. The fittest individuals in a population, he wrote, defined as those which leave the most offspring, will leave the most offspring. It's very hard to disprove a tautology, right? But this isn't the issue. The issue is this. Can this result in a new species? This is a quote taken from Darwin's first printing of The Origin of Species. He was asked to come up with an example. He couldn't come up with an empiric example, so he came up with a philosophical example. I can see no difficulty in a race of bears being rendered by natural selection more and more aquatic in their habitats with larger and larger mouths till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale. I'll let that sink in for a few minutes. He's saying that bears can turn into whales by natural selection. Darwin was a breeder. He made that... Yeah, that's a whale. He made that statement, right, based on his experience as a breeder. Right? Breeders do that. They select for traits and they try and enrich the population. Right? That's why we get our modern dairy cows and dogs and things like that. But there are very well characterized limitations to that. He knew this. Ernst Mayr, this is a man who was a very famous zoologist. He was full professor at Harvard, 1953 to 1975. He did his own breeding experiments with now a very widely and very famous, or very famously used model of genetics called a fruit fly, right? Drosophila. Right? What he was trying to do was breed a strain of this fly that had almost no hair left on its legs. Right? So flies have hairy legs, and he was going to select for flies that didn't have hairy legs. Well, he got a couple of generations in, and he ended up with a strain that was sterile. And just this doesn't just happen in flies. It happens with whatever animal you want to pick. But Ernst Mayr did that experiment, and he drew a couple of conclusions. First, he wrote, obviously, any drastic improvement under selection must deplete the store of genetic variability. He also arrived at the conclusion that the frequent correlated response of one-sided selection is a drop in general fitness. This plagues virtually every breeding experiment, right? So there's a drop in general fitness. By selecting, you're actually making the individual less fit, okay? So this was summed up in a term which we now know as genetic homeostasis, right? So let's talk about genetic homeostasis. It's defined as the tendency of Mendelian populations to maintain a constant genetic composition in the face of external pressure. Let's simplify that a little bit. That is the tendency of a population to reach a point of genetic equilibrium and resist changes. Let's simplify that even more. There is a limit to how much a species can change by selection, natural or otherwise. Okay? So a species can only change so far before the variability that species has is exhausted. I'll give you a current example. Let's look at sickle cell anemia. This is often used as an example of how humans are adapting and evolving. Sickle cell anemia is caused by a mutation in the hemoglobin gene that results in sickle-shaped red blood cells. Red blood cells bring oxygen to all parts of your body. When we change the shape, it does this less efficiently, right? One copy of this allele, you have two copies of every gene you have. One copy of it provides resistance to malaria. This is good because we usually see this in places that are stricken with malaria. Two copies, however, is fatal. Right? So you can see just by that kind of balance, the number of total sickle cell anemia hemoglobin alleles is controlled in a given population. You can't have everybody running around with two copies. It's self-monitoring. It kind of shuts itself down. In other words, there's a limit to which a population can carry certain traits. Right? This is genetic homeostasis. So an evolutionist will tell you, well, that's where mutation comes in. Right? Mutation is going to give us new information. So can mutations push us past this barrier of genetic homeostasis? No. No, it can't. All right, let's cause a mutation. Right? Let's see. I have a DNA sequence. This is where it's going to get really egg-heady, so pay attention. All right, so here we have a DNA sequence. I've grouped it in threes. This is how the machinery in your cells, right? It's actually a multi-stepped and very complex process to turn this into protein. But we're gonna simplify it a little bit and take a look at just the DNA. So I have them grouped in threes, and that's because the machinery in your cells reads your DNA three nucleotides at a time. Right? These are called codons. Codons code for these things called amino acids. Don't let that intimidate you. Amino acids make proteins, right? And proteins, of course, make all the things that are functional in the cell. Right? So we start with an ATG, which codes a methionine, right? And then these three code an arginine, then histidine, then a proline, then aspartic acid. That's not important. What is important is that there's a stop codon. Right? So So you go so far, and there's a stop codon. So the machinery in your cell knows to start here, can read that, and to stop there. It's pretty simple. All right, so now let's cause a mutation. We'll take that same DNA sequence, which causes what or codes for what we just saw, and let's delete a single nucleotide. That's one nucleotide. You have 3.4 billion of them. Let's take one out. All right, so now the machinery in your cell is going to read this like this. ATG, as it did before, CGT, CTC, CTC. Right, so I'll make an alignment. So let's see how that DNA now gets translated. We start with a methionine again. We have an arginine. Now we have a difference. We have another difference and another difference. And now we don't have a stop codon anymore. And it just goes on and on and on. Right? So I chose this as an example to show you that even a single base deletion in a coding segment of DNA can result in a massive loss of protein function. That if whatever function this had up here, right, this five amino acid protein is gone. Most of the amino acids now have changed, and it's not even the right size. But are there good mutations, right? Like X-Men. Can you get Cyclopses running around and Wolverines? Right? So for that to happen, right, mutations must be carried in a gametic cell to be inherited. Gametic cells are sperm cells and egg cells. Right? These are the cells that you impart to your children. If the mutation isn't there, your children can't have them. It can't be an evolutionary advantage because it ends with you. Right? So the mutation must get into your gametic cells. Does this happen? Well, let's make a side note. Mutations do occur in body cells, in somatic cells. Does anyone know what it usually results in? Cancer. Right? Like an oncogenic gene, like RAS, a mutation in RAS causes cancer. A tumor suppressor gene, like P53, mutation in that causes cancer. But does this kind of thing, where mutations can exist in gametic cells, does that happen in nature? Yes, absolutely. What's the result? Neurofibromatosis, Down syndrome, Fragile X, Huntington's cornea, dwarfism, ataxia, Angelman's, Prader-Willi, Tay-Sachs, PKU. Does anyone see a pattern? It's rarely good. In fact, we haven't observed advantageous mutations. What about large numbers? A neo-Darwinist will tell you that with a large enough population, we're eventually going to see an advantageous mutation. In other words, anything is possible if you give it enough chances to happen. Right? This is called the science of large numbers. Right? Anything's possible if you wait long enough, right? So let's look at some large numbers. Some people smarter than me that I'm going to quote. Hubert P. Yockey, he was a full professor at Berkeley. He also worked on the Manhattan Project. He said, the probability of a protein containing 100 amino acids, that's a very simple protein, forming, the probability of that forming spontaneously would be 1 in 10 to the 65th at best. So if you take all the amino acids that make up that protein, put them in a soup, and you say go, the chances of you getting a properly ordered 100 amino acid protein is 1 in 1 times 10 to the 65th power. It's extremely unlikely. You're going to be waiting a while. Robert Sauer of MIT later confirmed that work in 1983. And he also added that amino acids have discrete properties and are not unilaterally interchangeable. That means you can't just stick any amino acid in where another one is. You can do it to a degree, but you can't do it unilaterally. Right? So there's meaning. There's meaning to your DNA. There's a purpose. Finally, Murray Eden, also of MIT, calculated that a very simple synthesis could be expected to happen once every 1,000 million years. Does anyone remember how old the uniformitarian says we are? 4.6 billion. Right? So how many proteins or how many simple syntheses can we have by now or should we have by now? A little more than 4.5, right? We're almost on our way to 5. Right? You have billions of them going on right now, even while you're sitting out of here in your seats, bored out of your mind. Your cells are just working overtime. All right, so some things to consider here. Higher order metazoans, like us, have multiple DNA damage repair mechanisms. We actually, our cells don't like damage. And we have multiple ways of recognizing it. When the bases don't fit together, we have machinery in the cell to come cut it out and replace it. The time it would take to evolution to have occurred on the uniformitarian timescale is impossible. Even with that 4.6 billion years, based on our known mutation rate, how well a species changes over time and all those things, it's still impossible, let alone the 6,000 years that we get using helium dating. And finally, there is no sufficient mechanism for expanding or contracting genomes to account for the variety observed in nature. All right, so let's look at this word genome. So what is a genome? This is all the genetic information encoded in an organism. In other words, it's like an encyclopedia of all the blueprints that make you you. Right? So let's look at some genomes for a few organisms. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, this is baker's yeast, right? It has 12.5 million base pairs, right? And all the genes in it is a little under 6,000 genes. Let's look at, this is an example of Archaebacteria. This is supposed to be the simplest, and therefore the oldest, form of life on the planet. 490,000 base pairs, right? And about 552 genes. Let's look at humans. 3.4 billion base pairs, 20 to 25,000 genes. All right, there's a big difference between what's supposed to be the beginning and where we are. There's a lot of information gap there. All right? And just to put that in perspective, genetic expansion of genetic information has never been observed at this magnitude. Never. We just can't account for that much DNA appearing, and not only appearing, but coding for meaningful things, and having regulatory sequences and all the rest. Even though, you know, we used to say that we had all this intronic DNA that was useless in our genome, and we're finding out now, even in the last 4 or 5 years, that supposedly useless DNA is actually vital for regulation. All right. So let's take an example here. Let's say. Bear with me here. Let's say there are two circles. Let's say these represent organisms today. Right? They're very much alike. They're the same shape, different colors, and different sizes. An evolutionist would say that another color, another colored circle, right, evolved into these two. Let's put some faces on these. Well, let's first say it happens through the black box of evolution. So now we'll put some faces on. Let's say we have a brown bear here, which supposedly evolves into a polar bear and a black bear, right? And it happens through this black box of evolution, right? And you ask, okay, so what's happening with this evolution? And you have terms thrown at you. Oh, it happens by mutation. You get from here to here and here to here by mutation. You say, well, that's a lot of mutation. I don't understand how that could happen. And then they throw at you the term time. So it's a lot of mutation and a lot of time. And you say, well, there couldn't possibly have been that much time. You take a good hard look at the evolution box, and it really doesn't work. And that there is actually no link of descent here, that these animals are mutually exclusive. Right? Let's look at mutation over time. Right? So a Darwinist will tell you that you can change into a new organism. Right? Something like this. You have to bear with my bad graphics. Right? Let's just say the color of the bird is getting darker over time. Right, so by mutation, a species can change over time, but it can't originate by mutation or natural selection. It can't account for this guy. Right? I mean, this is a highly ordered animal. And so it can change over time, but you can't get this from nothing. Okay? It's also important to note that a new species has never been observed by mutation. We have never seen it. And all the time now that genetics has taken off, we've never watched one species turn into another species. And we've been trying. We've been trying with breeding experiments for years. In fact, think of dogs, right? We've been breeding dogs for hundreds of years, and we still haven't come up with a new species. There's an extreme difference in phenotypic variety there. You have big dogs and small dogs and hairy dogs, right? But they're all dogs. Darwin's book says origin of species. It doesn't say how species change over time, right? So the mechanism, I'm moving now into my last point here about the mechanism of evolution. Reproductive advantage. Now supposedly when you get this magical mutation that makes you better than your peers, you get a reproductive advantage, and so you proliferate more than your peers. So this is the main belief in evolution, right? This idea seems correct, but it's actually wrong. This is how I was taught the evolution of the nucleus of the cell, right? So the DNA in your cells doesn't just hang around, you know, floating around in space. It's actually sequestered in the nucleus. It's set aside in its own double membrane envelope in the nucleus, right? And since that stuff, the nucleus, is made up of the same stuff that makes up your cell membrane, evolutionists will tell you, well, you know, the cell membrane just wrapped around the DNA until you had a nucleus. This is literally how I was taught this, right? So here now, over millions of years, you start with the bacteria cells. Each one of these is going to represent a population, right? You see an outgrowth coming from the plasma membrane and slowly wrapping its way around the DNA. And then you get a nucleus. Now, I remember sitting in class and having some big problems with this. And I was an avid evolutionist because I'm trained as a biologist. However, this didn't make any sense to me at all. There's some problems here. For a cell to make these flaps consistently, because remember, every one of these represents a population existing in cells that kind of look like that. Right? So it has to make this. These things don't happen in a vacuum. It costs your cells energy to make things. Right? So the fact that there's energy required to make these things, that extra energy requirements put these cells at a reproductive disadvantage in a population of bacteria cells. There's another problem. The outgrowth is useless until it's completely formed. That's an example of a phenomenon called irreducible complexity. That is, that something as it exists now is so complex that in any other iteration without it existing in its complete form, it's useless, right? So it doesn't pay for your cells to make this until it's completely made. The third problem is this. This is the biggest problem that I had. That the nuclear membrane is a highly ordered structure with highly ordered pore complexes. That's how things get in and out of the nucleus. These would have to have evolved simultaneously with the membrane. Right? So while all this is going on, there are pore complexes that have to be kind of, you know, finding their own way into existence, that each one of them themselves is probably more complex than the car you drove here in today. Right? So these two working simultaneously, the chances are very good. Some more things to consider. Things don't spontaneously order. In fact, as Pat was saying, the second law of thermodynamics tells us that they are inclined to increasing disorder. And finally, there are some famous 20th century scientists that did not believe in evolution, not the least of which is Francis Collins. That's the current head of the NIH. That's arguably the most prestigious scientific position that you can have in this country, and some would argue in the world. Finally, I'll just leave you with some Bible verses to consider when you're thinking about evolution. 1 Corinthians 1:5, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. 1 Corinthians 3:19, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. And finally, a verse that I hope is near and dear to all of you. Psalms 14:1, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. So, that's all I have. I'm going to turn it back over to Pat.